level, known to most of us anyways. He is an audio engineer at the Crane School of Music at SUNY Potsdam, where he also teaches courses in musical literature. He is the author of over 150 articles and reviews on music and technical subjects. He's a sound recording review editor for the ARS Journal and co-chair of the ARS Technical Committee. He's review editor of Audio Electronics Magazine and the author of the loudspeaker entry in the Encyclopedia of Recorded Sound in the United States. He's reviewed books for Notes and has also been published in the newsletter of the Wilhelm Furtwängler Society of America. He's going to talk to us today on the use of the accordion with Toscanini and Furtwängler things. It has something to do with it, I'm sure.
I seem to have brought the wrong paper. So instead of the accordion, today's presentation will be Furtwängler and Toscanini, Myth and Reality. Traditionally, Wilhelm Furtwängler and Arturo Toscanini have been placed at opposite ends of the musical spectrum by both their admirers and their detractors. The most common generalization about these two conductors concerns tempi. Toscanini's are fast and Furtwängler's are slow. Beyond that, Toscanini's the classicist, the objectivist, whose fidelity to the score has become almost a cliché. Furtwängler is the epitome of the late 19th century conductor, a subjective, recreative interpreter. Toscanini is largely an in-time conductor, rarely deviating from the tempo established at the beginning of a work or movement unless specifically instructed to do so by the composer. It is Furtwängler, by contrast, who frequently modifies the musical pulse, often sweeping the listener through radical shifts in tempo. Most of the generalizations about Furtwängler and Toscanini have been based on a relatively small number of recordings made during the last few years of their careers. Today, I propose to show through recorded evidence that the performing styles of these two conductors are far too complex to summarize in a few sentences based on only a handful of recorded evidence. As we shall see, Furtwängler and Toscanini evolved considerably as conductors, and their familiar post-World War II recordings are often radically different from their pre-war counterparts. Although neither conductor was completely comfortable in the recording studio, the live performances of Furtwängler in particular often differ considerably from his efforts under studio conditions. Furtwängler and Toscanini are often regarded as contemporaries since the careers of both conductors ended the same year. In reality, Toscanini was a generation older than Furtwängler. Toscanini was born in 1867 and was 19 years of age when he made his conducting debut in 1886, which was the year of Furtwängler's birth. Toscanini conducted his final concert with the NBC Symphony on April 4, 1954, and entered retirement following his final recording sessions in June of that year. Furtwängler died in November of 1954, and I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that Toscanini's career and Furtwängler's lifetime spanned the same 68 years. The Italian maestro died 3 years later in 1957 at the age of 89. This paper emphatically will not tread the misguided and all too familiar Furtwängler versus Toscanini territory, which has been done so often in the past. There's now an abundant body of recorded evidence and ample justification for placing both at the head of any conceivable list of the 20th century's greatest conductors. The repertoire that I've selected for these comparisons today will consist of works by Beethoven and Wagner, and I have two reasons for doing that. Number one, the music of both of these composers was central to the repertoire of these two conductors. And the second, even more practical, both conductors left a sufficient number of surviving recordings of music by these composers from the pre- and post-war eras to allow meaningful comparisons. And we'll begin our comparisons with the Symphony No. 5 in C minor by Beethoven. For these comparisons, I will play four performances. And in the interest of saving time, I will play only the expositions. You all have a handout, and on your handout, there are timings for all the musical examples I'm going to play, plus there's some additional material on the other pages of the handout, which I'll explain a little bit later. The timings in parentheses on your handout for the Beethoven fifth examples are for the entire movement without exposition repeat. Toscanini's interpretation of the Beethoven symphonies are best known through his complete NBC symphony cycle recorded by RCA Victor between 1949 and 1952. And these were a combination of studio recordings and live performances, live broadcast performances. The performance of the Fifth Symphony included in this collection was a live telecast which aired on March 22, 1952. Because of the time constraints of broadcast, Toscanini omitted the first movement exposition repeat in the telecast. And the repeat that's featured on the commercial issue of the recording was actually manufactured by the recording engineers at the conductor's request. Basically, the exposition was copied on a tape and it was spliced in to create the repeat. We'll begin with Toscanini's March 22, 1952 live performance. Track 4, please. This performance is typical of Toscanini's Beethoven during the final years of his career. The nearly 85-year-old conductor offers a brisk, no-nonsense reading. The performance is rather hard-driven, tightly controlled, and nearly free of adjustments in tempo. From 1929 until 1936, Toscanini was principal conductor of the Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra of New York, I think arguably the finest orchestra he ever conducted. Although his commercial recorded output with this orchestra is relatively small, we are fortunate to have two surviving live Toscanini recordings of the Beethoven Fifth from this period. The performance which follows from April 9, 1933 makes an interesting comparison and contrast to the NBC performance we just heard, track 5. Parts of this performance are different enough from its 1952 NBC counterpart that they could well have been by a different conductor. We often read of the elasticity in Toscanini's conducting, but there's little evidence of it by 1952. In this 1933 New York performance, by contrast, Toscanini is more relaxed and surprisingly flexible. There's a retard at the first cadence point, along with a more pronounced broadening of tempo for the second theme. Throughout his career, Toscanini's performances were known for their intensity. The 1933 performance is certainly intense without simply being tense. In 1933, the exposition took 8 seconds longer than in 1952. And by 1952, Toscanini had shaved a half minute off the entire movement. Toscanini's commercially issued NBC Beethoven cycle gives at best an incomplete picture of his approach to these works. 12 performances of the Beethoven Fifth survive in recordings by Wilhelm Furtwängler, 9 of which are live. The most recent addition to this discography is the discovery by René Trémine of Terra Productions of a live performance with the Berlin Philharmonic from September 13, 1939, held in the archives of Reichsender Berlin. Both of Furtwängler's pre-war recordings of this work were done in the studio, in 1926 for Polydor and again in 1937 for HMV. This newly discovered live recording is nearly pre-war, having been made only 12 days after Hitler's invasion of Poland. Although Furtwängler took the exposition repeat in both of the performances we shall sample today, the timings that you have in parentheses on your handout are for the entire movement without repeat so that they can be compared to Toscanini's. Here is that recently discovered Furtwängler performance, September 13th, 1939, track 6. There are some surprising similarities between this performance and the Toscanini broadcast from 1933. And although the differences in timing are not particularly significant, it is Toscanini who lags behind Furtwängler by 2 seconds in the exposition and 6 seconds in the entire movement. Both conductors are flexible with tempo, with Furtwängler operating over an only slightly wider range than Toscanini. And the differences, I think, are generally those of detail rather than overall conception. As an example, Furtwängler broadens the tempo in preparation for the second theme, whereas Toscanini makes his adjustment after the second theme has begun. One fundamental difference between these two conductors concerns orchestral sonority. Even in the primitive 1933 recording, Toscanini's interest in orchestral brilliance and clarity is evident. And by contrast, the Furtwängler sound is weightier, built upon the foundation of the low strings. But in matters of tempo, they have little about which to argue in these two performances. For many years, Furtwängler's reputation as a Beethoven conductor rested primarily on the studio recordings of 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, made with the Vienna Philharmonic between 1950 and 1954. Here is the first movement exposition from the HMV studio recording of the Fifth Symphony, made during the last year of Furtwängler's life on February 28, 1954, track 7. Thank you. is from performances like this that Furtwängler's reputation for slow tempos emerged. In the 15 years that have elapsed since the previous performance, Furtwängler has added 7 seconds to the exposition and 42 seconds to the entire movement. In the 1930s, Furtwängler and Toscanini shared a great deal of common ground, but by the early 1950s, they are poles apart and they've moved in opposite directions. Typical of Furtwängler's work in the recording studio, tempo adjustments are more subtle than in his live performances, even those from the same period as this. Now we'll move on to Wagner. Both of the complete surviving Furtwängler performances of Wagner's Der Ring des Nibelungen were made with Italian orchestras, but under entirely different conditions. The 1950 La Scala performances were fully staged and recorded live for subsequent broadcast by RAI. In the fall of 1953, Furtwängler prepared another complete ring in Italy, recorded specifically for radio broadcast. The 1953 Rome performances were given in concert version, one act per evening in front of an invited audience. And for each act, there would be 3 or 4 days of rehearsal, followed by a concert performance of that act. Though both of the Furtwängler Italian ring cycles circulated on private labels in the 1950s and 1960s, the official EMI issue of the Rome performance in 1972 marked the first time a complete Furtwängler ring had been made available to the general public. The excerpt I've chosen is the conclusion of Act 2, Scene 4 of Götterdämmerung, where Siegfried denies Brunhilde's accusations of treachery. On page 3 of your handout, you have a libretto and translation for this scene. In the 1953 Rome performance, Siegfried is sung by Ludwig Suthaus, Hagen is Josef Greindl, and Brunhilde is Marta Myrtle. Track 8.
Thank you.
Furtwängler came to recognize the value of performing Wagner's music dramas in concert form only during the last years of his life. In 1953, he's free of the distraction of the theater, and he is able to probe the work on purely musical grounds. This is very much an orchestral performance, with the conductor carefully illuminating Wagner's orchestral counterpoint and the place of the singers in the overall contrapuntal fabric. Furtwängler's ability to sustain the long Wagnerian line is evident even in this relatively brief excerpt. Furtwängler conducted The Ring at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden during the 1937 and 1938 seasons. In these live theatrical performances, the London audiences witnessed some of the century's foremost Wagner singers, Lauritz Melchior as Siegfried, Kirsten Flagstedt as Brünnhilde in 1937, followed by Frieda Leiter in 1938 in what would be Leiter's last performances in London. Here is the same excerpt recorded live at Covent Garden on June 7, 1938. Melchior and Leiter are joined by the Hagen of Wilhelm Scherp. Track 9. Thank you. 15 years prior to the Rome performance and in the heat of live theater, Furtwängler is an entirely different conductor. This performance is permeated by a white heat, parts of which I think are best described as controlled abandon. Furtwängler's primary concern is dramatic intensity and continuity, and he beats his Rome timing by 1 minute and 21 seconds. I think it's interesting to note that the same music in the 1950 La Scala performance at 5 minutes and 42 seconds is closer to Covent Garden than to Rome. Toscanini treated New York's Carnegie Hall audiences to 6 performances of Act 1, Scene 3 of Die Walküre between 1932 and 1949. 3 were with the New York Philharmonic and 3 more with the NBC Symphony. Fragments of the November 27, 1932 performance survive on pre-cut Victrolac discs recorded off the air on non-professional equipment. Although the sound is admittedly extremely crude, the fragments from this concert are the earliest live Toscanini Wagner performances known to survive on recordings. In the opening portion of this scene, Siegmund calls to his father, whom he knows only as Velza, for the sword that was promised him in time of need. Here is that excerpt taken from the 1932 Toscanini broadcast. It begins on letter A on page 4 of your handout and continues to letter B. And there's also a libretto and translation for this scene on page 5. Toscanini's Siegmund in this performance is Paul Althaus, track 10. Thank you. I heard this performance for the first time in 1992 at the Museum of Radio and Television in New York, and I have to admit I was overwhelmed by its broad pacing. Toscanini had made his Bayreuth debut in 1930, only 2 years before this broadcast. And the following season, 1931, he led the longest Parsifal in the history of the Bayreuth Festival at 5 hours and 5 minutes. To those familiar with the NBC Symphony Wagner recordings, it's difficult to imagine, but when I first heard this New York Philharmonic performance, it made it finally possible for me to believe the Bayreuth timings. Toscanini gave his first NBC broadcast of this scene in an all-Wagner concert given on February 22, 1941, and featuring the distinguished soloist Lawrence Melchior and Helen Traubel. Here's the same excerpt taken from the 1941 broadcast with Melchior as Siegmund, track 11. Well, in the 9 years that have elapsed since the New York Philharmonic performance, Toscanini has trimmed nearly 40 seconds from this passage. Now, I know there are those of you out there who will say that that's due to Melchior rushing the conductor, which the great Dane was certainly known to do. However, in the NBC broadcast of April 6, 1947, in which Siegmund was sung by Setz von Holm, normally a musically conscientious singer, we still find Toscanini over 25 seconds faster than in the New York Philharmonic performance. In the 1947 performance, Toscanini actually begins a noticeable increase in tempo 2 measures before Siegmund's entrance. So although Melchior does admittedly push Toscanini a bit, Toscanini's more rapid tempi in his NBC performances of this scene appear to be primarily his own choice. The NBC recordings of this complete scene, incidentally, are the longest surviving documents of music from Wagner's Ring conducted by Toscanini. Next, I'd like to play excerpts from 2 performances of the prelude to Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, one from the same 1932 Toscanini New York Philharmonic broadcast, and another from a broadcast with the Berlin Philharmonic conducted by Furtwängler on April 27, 1954. The Toscanini recording is fragmentary. It's missing the first 16 measures and another measure and a half near the end. And for that reason, I'll start these comparisons on the second page of the full score. The first excerpt begins at letter A on page 6 of the handout score and continues through letter B. Toscanini will be played first, followed directly by Furtwängler, track 12. Near the beginning of this work, Toscanini is substantially slower than Furtwängler. The exact tempos are a bit difficult to pin down since both conductors are extremely fluid. Indeed, the fabled Toscanini elasticity is heard to abundance in this performance. However, at the beginning of this scene, the eighth note equals approximately 52 beats per minute in the Toscanini performance and approximately 63 in Furtwängler's. Another thing that I think is noteworthy is the use of string portamento in the Toscanini recording, which by 1950 had fallen out of favor in orchestral performance, and I would say one is hard-pressed to find string portamento in any of the NBC Symphony performances under this conductor. In 1909, in reviewing Toscanini's first Tristan at the Metropolitan Opera, New York Sun critic W.J. Henderson noted that the entire first act was very slow. The 1932 New York Philharmonic recording may provide at least a hint of the Met performance 23 years earlier. Now, let's observe how each conductor approaches the climax of the prelude. The excerpt begins at letter C on page 7 of your handout and continues through letter E on page 8. We'll hear Furtwängler first, followed by... Thank you. Well, again, tempos are extremely fluid in both performances, but at letter D, the eighth note equals approximately 88 in the Furtwängler performance and approximately 100 in Toscanini's. It's Furtwängler who's best known for the extremes of tempi in his performances, and all of his surviving recordings of the Tristan Prelude are characterized by a gradual increase in tempo as he approaches the climax of the work. Yet in the 1954 performance, he worked within a narrower framework than did Toscanini in 1932. Indeed, it is Toscanini who operated at the extremes in 1932, beginning the prelude slower than Furtwängler, yet building to a considerably faster tempo by the time he arrived at letter D. Both conductors pull back two measures before the climax, Toscanini to at least as great a degree as Furtwängler. As I mentioned before, the Toscanini broadcast recording is incomplete, but the timing of the surviving material is 9 minutes and 24 seconds. In 1954, Furtwängler performed the exact same music in 9 minutes, nearly a half minute faster than Toscanini. Furtwängler made his first recordings for Polydor in 1926 at the age of 40, only 2 years after having been appointed principal conductor, only 4 years, excuse me, after having been appointed principal conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra upon the death of Arthur Nikisch. His total discography consists of well over 450 entries, the vast majority being recordings of live performances. This leaves us a fairly complete picture of his conducting style. Toscanini, on the other hand, was 53 years old when he made his first recordings with the La Scala Orchestra in 1920, but these sessions, for the most part, consisted of short, lighter works. It wasn't until 1929, age 62, that he made his first complete recordings of major symphonic literature with the Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra of New York. Documentation of live Toscanini performances would have to wait another 2 years when Victor would finally attempt to capture a complete Beethoven Fifth under his direction. Toscanini's recording career, at least as far as the major literature is concerned, major literature recorded more or less complete, begins at an age when many musicians are contemplating retirement. Although American audiences know him primarily for his work in the concert hall, Toscanini first achieved world renown as an opera conductor. He was music director at La Scala from 1898 until 1903, and he returned to that house between 1906 and 1908, and again from 1920 until 1929. His tenure at the Metropolitan Opera in New York from 1908 until 1915 was certainly among the most important in his career. Unfortunately, we have no recorded documentation of these activities. And given the changes in style which can be documented through his recordings, we can't help but wondering what he was like as a middle-aged conductor. Toscanini's recorded output, if one includes both commercial recordings and live broadcast material, could easily occupy 150 compact discs. Yet despite this sizable discography, the picture will remain forever incomplete. The generalizations perpetuated about these conductors can certainly be supported if one examines only recordings made in the late 1940s, between the late 1940s and 1954. Yet to continue to characterize the work of these two conductors based on this handful of recorded evidence is to perpetuate a myth. As we have seen here today, a more complete examination of their recorded output reveals a very different reality. The interpretations of Furtwängler and Toscanini as documented by recordings change considerably over the years, making generalizations difficult and misleading. I'd like to conclude the presentation with an excerpt from the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven. The best known performances of the Ninth by these two conductors certainly support the conventional wisdom. The total timing of Toscanini's NBC studio recording from 1952 is nearly 10 minutes faster than Furtwängler's live performance given at the reopening of the Bayreuth Festival the year before, 1951. Yet comparisons of certain passages in the score reveal some interesting surprises. Here is the conclusion of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, Toscanini in 1952, followed by Furtwängler the previous year, track 16.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see two questions. Jerry first, and then David Hall. Jerry?
Jerry, if you don't mind, I have something to add in contrast to what you said. I think it's interesting enough to lay out. I just finished counting the plannings of 167 shooting night symphonies. I took the slow movement hit, which is not affected by repeats, and arranged them in order. As you know, both Toscanini and Bert Benger made highly praised studio recordings of this work. And in my list of 167 recordings are 5 by Toscanini and 6 by Bert Benger. And the 5 by Toscanini are among the 20 fastest. And the 6 by Bert Benger are among the 10 slowest. In between, the slowest Toscanini and the fastest Bert Benger are 140 other recordings. It does contrast.
Well, it does, but let me say something about that. I did something similar to this on our local public radio station a couple of years ago, and I compared the 1942 Furtwängler live wartime Schubert Ninth Symphony with Toscanini's Philadelphia recording from 41 or 42, I forget the exact date, and I played the last movement in both of them in its entirety, and Furtwängler beat Toscanini by a considerable amount. So my point is, yes, you can find performances that will support the conventional wisdom, but you can find many others which will reveal just the opposite. Again, the generalizations don't hold up. Case by case basis. David.
Well, I'm speaking partly as a result of having been on the production staff of the NBC Symphony for 6 years with Toscanini, and heard most of the rehearsals, and God knows how many live performances before that. Anyway, two comments. I'm very sorry that Seth Winter was not able to restore the last Philharmonic broadcast of the Ninth Symphony with the Philharmonic Symphony of New York with Toscanini, which is a broadcast that I will never forget. I have heard the recording, which is pretty crude. Walter Toscanini played it for me. I hope that in one way or another, simply as a document, that this will be restored so that there will be
a complete source of that we found.
This is not the one that was from 1935 that Toscanini Society put out an LP. This is after that?
36, yeah. Okay. The Toscanini Society LP has holes in it that was patched with a commercial Beethoven ninth you heard by somebody by putting a microphone in front of a speaker and crackling to a saran wrap. The only way to do it to make it match. We don't have the
final Philharmonic broadcast performance. Yeah. Is the performance to end them all, if you can only get it in decent sound. As I say, this is something that I only heard it on the radio, but it still sticks.
Well, I have to agree, as many New York Philharmonic Toscanini broadcasts as can possibly be restored, I'm all for it. He's going to kill me after this presentation. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
The other comment is a hypothetical question.
Okay.
To wit, I have wondered in my mind, year after year after year, what would have happened to Toscanini's performances if he had not been stuck with Studio 8H to rehearse in, which had no decay time. So my theory about Toscanini's Fast Tempi is that the lack of decay time in Studio 8H.
But what about the Carnegie, Beethoven, I think your point is well taken, I really do.
I'm taking this as an overview of Toscanini's performances during his NBC period.
But 8H wasn't being used after what, 50 or 51?
50.
And that Beethoven Fifth I played from 52, that was done in Carnegie Hall.
Well, this is a case of old dogs and new tricks, I mean, to some extent. Okay. But I think that 8H didn't
help. They may have illuminated. I think part of it was the problem with the stopwatch, trying to make things fit for the concerts. Because I found through the Library of Congress that most of the 1950 tour, and he does an heroic tape it. They got it on Lacrosse. We have that. We have 11 out of the 22 concerts from that.
Go for it.
Well, again, I would agree from a number of, you know, from a number of live things that were not issued commercially from his latter years that, again, in many cases, the commercially issued records do not tell the whole story.
And certainly the BBC Brahms is a lot more relaxed than the NBC.
Absolutely. I agree.
The only satisfactory performance of the Brahms Third is the BBC, that I know of.
The third or the fourth?
Brahms Three.
No, there's no third.
There's no third with BBC.
The Philharmonia.
Oh, the Philharmonia.
I meant the Philharmonia.
Okay.
No, that's the only satisfactory Brahms Third, the Philharmonia, in my book. And he never was happy with it anyhow.
No, I know. Other questions? No. Jim says we're out of time. Thank you very much.